UK government might have shut down?
Let's end this shutdown right now. Let's put people back to work.
Listen, there's never been a president in our history that did not negotiate over the debt limit. Never. Not once.
But you can count on us. Welcome to News One Now with Roland Martin.
Good morning, I'm Roland Martin, broadcasting live from Sacramento, California. Today on News One Now, a contentious news conference for President-elect Donald Trump. He attacks the media. He also speaks about the issue of Russia. And he says he is going to turn his business over to his two sons. The problem is ethics experts say that simply is not enough. Also on today's show, history is made on day two of the Senate confirmation hearing of Jeff Sessions for Attorney General. Senator Cory Booker becomes the first sitting senator to speak out against another sitting senator. Also today, Ben Carson goes before the Senate as well. Also, folks, on Capitol Hill, members of Congress are battling over a piece of artwork out of Missouri. We'll tell you what's going on with taking this artwork down, putting it back up. Also on the show, Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke is trying to shake his murder charge in Laquan McDonald's shooting. We have those details. I'll also hear talk to State Senator Steve Bradford about how California say they could lead the way to help Democrats out of the abyss. And Hidden Figures, number one at the box office. Let's see what happens on weekend two. Time to bring the funk from Sacramento. News One Now on TV One. Drama, drama, drama. How else could you describe the news conference yesterday held by President-elect Donald Trump? It was his first news conference since he was elected 2 months ago, and it was contentious, and it was vintage Trump. It was at some point actually more like a reality show as he fought and battled the media, especially CNN, after they did a report talking about the issue of Russian intelligence possibly compromising Donald Trump. He was there with Vice President-elect Mike Pence and their families. Also, the room was stacked with staffers. So when you hear the applause there, that was actually staffers of Donald Trump who he brought into the news conference. It was a raucous affair. Here is some of what took place yesterday at Trump Tower.
As far as hacking, I think it was Russia, but I think we also get hacked by other countries and other people. If Putin likes Donald Trump, guess what, folks? That's called an asset, not a liability. Now, I don't know that I'm going to get along with Vladimir Putin. I hope I do, but there's a good chance I won't. And if I don't, do you honestly believe that Hillary would be tougher on Putin than me? Does anybody in this room really believe that? Give me a break. He shouldn't be doing it. He won't be doing it. Russia will have much greater respect for our country when I'm leading it than when other people have led it. You will see that. Russia will respect our country more. He shouldn't have done it. I don't believe he'll be doing it more.
Donald Trump also attacked the intelligence community for what he said, leaking the reports of his dossier and that it was presented to President Barack Obama as well as himself. And of course, he went after vigorously CNN and BuzzFeed for their reporting on this issue.
And I think it's a disgrace that information would be let out. I saw the information. I read the information outside of that meeting. It's all fake news. It's phony stuff. It didn't happen, and it was gotten by opponents of ours, as you know, because you reported it, and so did many of the other people. It was a group of opponents that got together, sick people, and they put that crap together. They looked at that nonsense that was released by maybe the intelligence agencies. Who knows? But maybe the intelligence agencies, which would be a tremendous blot on their record if they in fact did that, a tremendous blot, because a thing like that should have never been written, it should never been had, and it should certainly never have been released.
Joining us, folks, via Skype from New York City is Terrell Starr. He's a senior reporter for Foxtrot Alpha. There in the studio on our panel today is William Jawando, former official in the Obama administration. Kristen Clark, president and CEO of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. Ralph Chittums, the principal of Black Elephant Consultings. Amber J. Phillips, the co-director of Black. Terrell, I want to go to you first. I found it quite interesting that when Donald Trump was asked at that news conference, were there any relations, connections, communications between his staff and Russian officials, he would not answer that question, Terrell. That is a serious issue. And what's interesting is that Russia previously acknowledged there was communication between them and his campaign team.
Well, let's start off with the fact that, look, I've been studying Russia going on 15 years right now. Russia tends not to send wolf tickets. If they say they did something, they tend to not be lying. And the reason being is that they don't care about being caught. That is the whole basis of how Russia operates. Number two, you know, a lot of this stuff could easily be solved if Donald Trump, President-elect Donald Trump, releases tax returns. Look, I was in Ukraine just last week, and one of the stories I've been chasing down is one on Paul Manafort and his dealings with Russia and the connection with Trump. And, you know, of course, I ran into a number of dead ends. I'm going to keep on trying, but the problem is that when you have BuzzFeed and, you know, who released this dossier, for example, and he's upset about it, you know what? Show us your tax returns. Show us where your connections are in Russia so we can investigate that. So, you know, so we can remove all doubt, but he's unwilling to do that because, in my mind, he's hiding something. We can't exactly prove the connections, and most of this is his fault.
In fact, yesterday at the news conference, he addressed that issue, and he said, I don't need to release my taxes. I won. So he's saying that him winning means he doesn't need to release his taxes. You now have, of course, Congressman Mark Sanford, Republican from South Carolina, who say he should release his taxes because this is going to have an impact on future presidential campaigns.
Yeah, and I want to add on something to this, too. What a lot of people in America don't know is the work that we're doing, the questions of chasing down the money, this type of work gets Russian journalists killed. I want to make that perfectly clear. Journalists have died chasing down the kinds of stories that we're being asked to do. So we have colleagues, in order for this to work, we also have to have colleagues in Russia who have the freedom to do what we do. Do you really think that this back and forth goes on between journalists and Putin? No, they find themselves shot in the back of the head. All you have to do is do a basic Google search on journalists killed under Putin to find that out. And I think it's further irresponsible for Donald Trump to hide this because it makes people assume or believe that he's using Russia as nothing more than a Swiss bank account.
Right. All right, Terrell Starr, we surely appreciate you joining us today on News 19 TV1. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, let's go to our panel there in D.C. I'll start with you, Ralph. What is interesting to me, not just on the issue of the taxes in Russia, so here you have Donald Trump blasting leaks. This is the same guy who mentioned WikiLeaks 164 times throughout the campaign. This is the same guy who talks about fake news, who actually held news conferences where he was lying about President Barack Obama's birth certificate. And the media was sanctimonious, was actually covering it. I remember one of those news conferences where his plane flew in. That was the backdrop. And he's there talking about how a source called him with amazing information. He was sending private investigators. Who the hell is Donald Trump to complain about fake news when he actually presented fake news about President Barack Obama?
Well, fake news is fake news. And the fact is that supposed report was fake news. And trying to tie his tax returns to this report, what does a tax return have to do with a lie that he was in a room with two prostitutes? His tax return.
I'll tell you what, the tax return, Ralph,
lie that he was in a room with two prostitutes who did something disgusting on a bed.
But it was Ralph, in that dossier, it talked about Russia trying to reach Donald Trump with Russian business opportunities. Donald Trump has said on the record, Ralph, that his company had no business relations in Russia. Yet his own son said they had extensive business in Russia. Donald Trump, if he releases his taxes and releases who he owes debts to, will give us an indication if it is true or not. So, Ralph, answer that question. How can Donald Trump publicly say that he had no business ties, no business dealings in Russia, yet his own son contradicted exactly what he said?
Donald Trump does not manage the day-to-day operations of every entity inside of the Trump enterprise.
Yes, and, he does. He does.
But he doesn't. The person at the top, like a Donald Trump, does not make every decision for every entity that's under his name. Well, and everybody knows that's true.
Go ahead, Will.
I was just going to say, let's jump in. We're not talking about one or two deals. We're talking about the son's quote was money is flowing in from Russia, right? And reporters have known for years, 20 years, that Donald Trump has had dealings in Russia. So the tax returns are relevant because we need to know what those dealings are. They have risen to the level of a national security concern at this point.
No, I'm not saying
that
the tax
returns... need to know what his dealings are.
No, I'm not saying the tax returns aren't relevant. I'm saying, but to try to tie the tax returns to that part of the dossier, like the gentleman did in the clip. That's just ridiculous.
I think the overall point is that things are being
covered up.
You know,
Kristen, I want to go to you. I want to go to you because the head of the Office of Governmental Ethics, Donald Trump, yesterday also talked about how he was going to turn his business over to his two sons. He did not say he was going to divest. He did not say it was going to be a blind trust. And the head of the Office of Governmental Ethics said he will be breaking the law on day one as a result of this, that what he has described simply does not satisfy the law. He wants to flout the law and say that there are two standards. There's a standard for any other American president, and there's one for him.
You know, I think there are lots of conclusory statements that are being thrown around. You know, Trump has sold his business. There are no longer conflicts of interest. The reality is that it may take months to really shine a bright spotlight on what's happening here, to really figure out whether or not there are conflicts of interest that are going to create problems for the president-elect to do his job. I think that we're going to have to take some time to just really unpack all of this and figure out whether or not President-elect Trump is truly in a position, to carry out the duty of running the nation free from all of the current conflicts that we see with all of these business entanglements.
Yeah, and the other thing to remember, Roland, is that this report was commissioned by Republican opposition researchers, so it just was carried on after the election by others. And the idea that you have Donald Trump, who's criticized the Pope, in a whole list of long list of people, but he won't criticize Vladimir Putin, who's a KGB agent who has people killed. And you have to ask yourself, with all that evidence, why wouldn't he not be more forthcoming with one, criticism, but two, his dealings in Russia? And those are valid
questions. Amber, we saw yesterday, again, this raucous news conference. He attacked Jim Acosta, reporter for CNN, said, I'm not calling on you. It went lots of back and forth. He comes up there, lays out all these documents on a table, saying that these are all of the businesses and how we are turning over to my sons. But then they don't allow reporters to even look at the actual folders. So those could have been blank papers. I mean, is this what Americans can expect to see with President Donald Trump for the next 4 years?
I think Donald Trump has truly shown us who he is at this point. Maya Angelou said, when someone shows you who they are, believe them. He has shown us that he's not willing to tell the truth. He has shown us he's not willing to be, he's not going to cooperate by doing something as simple as turning over his tax reforms. So I think, yes, this is exactly what we're looking at. And it's scary going back to what was just said about what is happening in Russia with the news and how we're not even reporters and journalists are scared to chase down issues that are important. And my worry is that with the attack on BuzzFeed, with the attack on CNN, places where we know young people are getting their news, big parts of the American public are getting their news, Donald Trump is calling them fake news. How dangerous is that, going into an administration that is literally lying to us every day and then getting in front of our faces and saying, oh, you know, not really, I didn't mean it, I take it back.
Ralph, do you believe that what Donald Trump said yesterday by saying, oh, I'll turn over to my sons, as if they're going to be running the business, I have nothing to do with it, but he ends it by saying, well, they're not doing a good job, you're fired. That sounds to me like he is going to be over the business. Do you believe that he is playing a dangerous game by not divesting himself or putting it to a blind trust and simply saying, hey, America, trust me? He could have foreign governments literally, and then to say, well, any money from foreign government staying in my hotel, I'll turn it over to the U.S. Treasury. That is still a violation of the Constitution.
Well, it's also been reported by numerous constitutional lawyers that it's difficult to create a blind trust for ongoing businesses. Now, if you're talking about, passive investments,
but
Ralph, it's hard to put into a blind trust because the business is an ongoing entity that has to be managed on a day-to-day basis.
But Ralph, the point is this here. If you have Donald Trump's company doing business with foreign entities, he is in violation of the United States Constitution that says no president should be receiving monetary funds from a foreign entity.
But he is stepping over. He is stepping away from everything as far as the management of
his. Was to get rid of ethics. Of course, he's going to break these rules. Of course, we're not going to figure out the extent of where this is going to go until much later when it's too late. It's now easier to sell off national parks. Like, anything can happen. Let's just own that. Donald Trump is lying.
Kristen,
as a lawyer, Kristen.
If the president of the United States is receiving monetary funds from a foreign entity, he is in violation of the United States Constitution.
There is a provision of the Constitution that we don't hear about much, the Emoluments Clause provision of the Constitution, which prohibits precisely what you just said, Roland. And I think that it's a provision we're going to be hearing a lot more about over the course of the next 4 years. I think this is a moment that really requires that we shine a bright spotlight on what's happening with this president, both inside president-elect, both inside and outside the White House. I think you're exactly right. This is a matter of national importance, but has implications for how we deal with other countries around the world. But the Emoluments Clause, let's put it, let's really underscore it, a word we're going to be hearing a lot about in the years ahead.
And the lawyer that,
I got to go to a break. We come back, we're going to talk about the confirmation hearing of Senator Jeff Sessions, Senator Cory Booker, Congressman John Lewis. Both of them testified yesterday. We'll discuss that. Also, I'll talk right here in Sacramento with State Senator Steve Bradford about how California could actually be the state to hold President Donald Trump accountable. We'll discuss that with him as well. Also, in Maryland, they finally are going to court over trying to end the issue of segregation in their HBCUs, also were fighting over equal funding. Folks, we got a packed show for you. Keep it tuned right here. News One Now on TV One.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
America needs an attorney general who is resolute and determined to bend the arc. Senator Sessions' record does not speak to that desire, intention, or will.
We have come a distance. We have made progress, but we're not there yet. There are forces that want to take us back to another place. We don't want to go back. We want to go forward.
In his decades-long career in public life, Senator Sessions has proven himself unfit to serve in the role as Attorney General.
Folks, day two of the confirmation hearing of Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions took place on yesterday. Donald Trump has named him his attorney general. Powerful testimony yesterday from Congressman John Lewis, from Senator Cory Booker, from Congressman Cedric Richmond, chair of the Congressional Black Caucus. They made it perfectly clear that the record of Senator Jeff Sessions is simply unacceptable, especially when it comes to the issue of voting rights. Now, defenders of Senator Jeff Sessions say that he's not a racist. What ended up happening was several different people came up, testified, talked about his personal relationships with them as well. Let's go to our panel and talk about this. Here's what jumps out at me, Kristen. I'll start with you. To me, first of all, I'm not having this debate, racist, non-racist. I said that on the show the last couple of days. What this, for me, what this goes to is the actual record of Senator Sessions, his actual votes. I don't care if you showed up at the hospital when one of your black staffers had a baby. I don't care if you were to somebody's wedding. I don't care if you were a nice guy who they got along. The question is, did he take votes that block opportunities for Americans, for African Americans? And on the issue of voting, he said in his own testimony that he voted for the reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act, but he called the Voting Rights Act intrusive and has not supported fixing what the Supreme Court actually did in their decision in 2013 in the Shelby decision.
Everything that I heard during this two-day hearing confirms what we have long known about Mr. Sessions, that this is somebody who harbors great hostility and opposition to civil rights in every area, not just voting rights. The Voting Rights Act, our most important federal civil rights law, is something he deems intrusive, an intrusive piece of legislation. He did nothing over the past 2 days to suggest that that is not the view that he holds. I didn't hear any acknowledgement of the reality of voting discrimination and voter suppression that we wrestle with in this country today. There's a photo ID law in his state. He's got three high courts in the state of Alabama that are all white today because of voting discrimination that is rooted in his state of Alabama. I didn't hear any acknowledgement of that. We need an attorney general who is prepared to carry forth the legacy of Holder and Lynch and do the work that is necessary to move our nation forward. And it's not just voting rights. It's criminal justice issues and the legacy of mass incarceration. Right now, we are bracing for the announcement of potential consent decrees with the Baltimore Police Department and hopefully the Chicago Police Department. That is the kind of work that Mr. Sessions needs to be prepared to carry forward. And everything that I heard during this nomination hearing makes clear that he is somebody who is going to turn the clock back and who will not be a trusted enforcer of our nation's federal civil rights laws.
And the point,
Ralph?
Go ahead, Ralph. Jeff Sessions, I believe, and by his record, is a law and order person. So he is definitely going to enforce the laws of the United States. What he is not going to do is he is not going to continue the trend of turning the Justice Department into another legislative body. His job as the Attorney General is to enforce the laws, not make them. And that is exactly what he is going to do.
And Roland, a law, one of the premier laws in our country, is equal protection under the laws. And the reality is that inaction is action. And if he gets in there and guts the Civil Rights Department, reduces investigative authority, doesn't pursue cases, we need someone like Congressman John Lewis said, who's a hero and a legend and who should not have been pushed to the last panel yesterday either. We need someone who's going to be aggressive in defending rights. That's your job. As the U.S. Attorney General, and he has been clear through his record and his statements that he sees his job just to mind the store, at the best case scenario, mind the store, not pursue things, and inaction is action. And so that's why we have to be very leery of Jeff Sessions.
I didn't
Amber,
hear.
Amber, as an activist, are you concerned and fearful that Senator Jeff Sessions, if he is confirmed to be the Attorney General, that he will not meet with Black Lives Matter activists? He will not be aggressive when it comes to holding police departments accountable. He also in the past has been critical of these consent decrees, which is really the strongest power DOJ has holding police departments accountable for their actions.
I'm terrified for people on the ground, folks who, because they love their communities, people in Ferguson who are literally going to the streets to stand up for what they believe is right and what it means to have a person like Jeff Sessions in a position that will criminalize us, that will not take up the causes that are important to our communities. This is someone who, if Coretta Scott King has to take her pen to paper and say this person will undo the legacy of my husband, we should all be worried. And shout out to the activists, folks like Mike Sampson, who interrupted Jeff Sessions speaking to call him a racist, to say that he has ties to the KKK. And we need to keep talking about this because it matters. It matters who's honoring you. It matters that you are going to take one of the most important positions in this cabinet as someone who does not care about LGBTQ folks, Black folks, or women. This matters.
All right, folks, hold tight. 1 second. When we come back, we'll talk with California State Senator Steve Bradford about what this state is doing when it comes to continuing the legacy of President Barack Obama and how they have plans to hold Donald Trump accountable and to prevent some of his plans of action. Also, a desegregation case critically important to HBCUs is taking place in Maryland as we speak. We will talk about that as well. What's going on Capitol Hill? This battle over a painting, a temporary painting, taken down, put up, taken down, put up. Well, we'll explain to that for you as well. Folks, this is News One Now. I'm broadcasting from Sacramento, California. I'll be back on TV One in just a moment.
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.
All right, folks, states across the country are trying to figure out how do they deal with a Donald Trump presidency. Well, California, a strongly Democratic state, they say they are going to step up and fight anything that he tries to do. In fact, the state has actually hired former Attorney General Eric Holder to sort of lead in that effort. Join right now. I want to talk to State Senator Steve Bradford, who joins me here in Sacramento. Of course, I am here in Sacramento. I'll be speaking to the California Black Caucus later this morning for their MLK event. So looking forward to that. So, Steve, glad to have you on News One Now.
Thank you. Thank you for your invitation.
Let's talk about this plan for California. You had Governor Jerry Brown who said that, look, California, they are going to use their state power to fight anything that Donald Trump tries to roll back when it comes to health care, when it comes to the environment and issues like that.
Yes, we hired Eric Holder last week here in Sacramento, but the discussion is making sure we have a firewall here in California to protect, as you said, immigration, some of our labor issues that we fought hard for in California, the environmental positions that we've taken, but most importantly, Affordable Care Act. That means almost 2 million people will be out without health care, so we're here to protect covered California and everything else that we think is important.
So how do you actually do that, though? How does California fight a federal regulation, if you will, that Donald Trump is pushing or that Congress may implement?
Well, and that's the reason why we're hiring Eric Holder, who is deeply steeped in federal laws, more so than our attorney general, who is here to fight and protect state laws. So it's a combination of bringing back the best resources here to California to make sure we're in the best position to do so.
One of the other things that we have heard, and give us a status of that is I've heard other California officials want to have it as a mandate in order to get on the California presidential ballot, that a candidate has to release their taxes.
Yes, we've seen what happened last year in the election, and we're seeing that should be a number one prerequisite of running for presidency. Let us know who you are. Let us know who you are financially, and we still are in the dark of what Donald Trump's holdings are, what he's tied with. Many feel he's deeply invested or in debt to Russia, so I think your tax returns tell the real story of who you are.
There are 11 Black Caucus members here in California. And, of course, we know for a long time, Willie Brown was the Speaker of the House. And you've had a history of African-Americans being in power in this state. Where does the Black Caucus stand when it comes to driving these critical issues of importance to African-Americans?
I think we're going to be at the forefront. We're going to join hand-in-hand with Latino caucuses and other caucuses, but I think we're in a good position right now. We had a legislative retreat last week to discuss what our priorities are, economic development, improving education here in the state of California. Those things are critical and will remain critical to the African-American caucus. And I think our legacy, we're celebrating 50 years, as you well know, of having a caucus here in California, a Black caucus. So we're excited about being able to, again, to lead the way. It's often says, so goes California, so goes the nation. So the Black caucus is going to be at the forefront of that.
All right, then. Well, California Senator Bradford, we appreciate it. Thanks a bunch.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Thanks a bunch. All right, folks. Now let's talk about what's happening on Capitol Hill with a painting. Well, of course, Congressman Lacey Clay, there was an art contest. And so that was a young person in St. Louis who did this painting. In this painting, police officers are depicted as pigs. Well, that painting went up on temporary status in Capitol Hill. Then all of a sudden, Congressman Duncan Hunter decided that he said it should come down. It was an insult to cops. So he then takes upon himself to remove it. Well, that's actually a violation. Then, of course, Congressman Clay, joined by members of the CBC, put the painting back up. Then another member of Congress came by to take the painting back down. They put it back up. Here we have some video that was shot by Lawn Victoria Burke of Congressman Clay addressing the media with regards to this painting.
It is just pathetic that some Republican members and alt-right media types who constantly refer to themselves as constitutional conservatives don't think that that same document protects the fundamental free speech rights of my 18-year-old constituent.
It's not about the First Amendment, it's about the rules of the Capitol. You don't have First Amendment rights in the Capitol gallery, in the House gallery.
Congressman Clay said he is going to file a violation against Congressman Hunter for violating the Capitol rules, and we'll certainly see what happens here. I just want to go to a panel real quick here. Will, it's interesting to me, you see this battle over a temporary painting, yet you have a statue in Statuary Hall of one of the greatest traitors in American history, one of the greatest bigots in American history, and somebody, of course, who led the Confederacy, Jefferson Davis. You also have in Statuary Hall another statue of a Confederate general from the state of Florida, General Smith. And so I wonder if Congressman Hunter wants to physically remove those statues, because they are certainly an insult to African Americans and other Americans.
That's a great question. Or maybe we should ask Jefferson Beauregard Sessions, you know, about his namesake removing that statue. But, you know, the idea, of course, we're not going to remove those statues because they're part of American history. And we respect the First Amendment rights to free speech and expression. And the idea that the audacity of this Congressman Duncan Hunter to walk in, take the picture down. When he first took it down, he took it down, took it to Congressman Clay's office, who was not there, left it at the front desk, said, tell him to call me. I'll tell him while I took it down. The disrespect that he wouldn't even speak to the congressman about his issue before is just ushering in this level of incivility that is really led by the head of the Republican Party right now, Donald Trump.
I also just want to add that this painting clearly is giving over to Emory Douglas. This is an 18-year-old child who is clearly looking over their history, seeing how he depicted cops, because not all the cops in the picture are depicted as animals. There's one who is doing his job well, who is actually handcuffing someone and taking them through the process, who is depicted as a regular person. The thing that actually stood out to me was that there is a young person staple to the scales of justice. That's what we should be talking about. Right. That's what we really need to be saying. There's the St. Louis Arcs in the back. This is a young person who is very steeped in what's going on in this country right now. And I look forward to seeing it in the African American History Museum.
And how dangerous this concept.
Christy, go ahead.
How dangerous this idea that the First Amendment is not alive inside the halls of Congress. If there is anywhere where the Bill of Rights and our constitutional rights should be respected and alive and well, it is inside the halls of that Congress. So dangerous. And it makes me think about what we saw last week. Congress came back into session, and one of the first things they did was say, we're shutting down the First Amendment. Right. We're not going to allow lawmakers to use their phones to, have live feeds, or we're not going to support stage-ins. If you do this kind of conduct, we're going to fine you. A very dangerous thing happening right now in our country that we all should be paying attention to.
Getting back to the issue that we were talking about regarding this painting. While this painting is not one that I would personally purchase to hang in my home because I don't like it, I do agree that as a First Amendment issue, the artist has a right to make it, and the congressman has a right to hang it in that gallery. I mean, I'm sure every last one of us has walked through that hallway where there are hundreds of pictures that are hung on that particular wall. I mean, I just walked through that hallway this past Monday. So, you know, while it's personally, I wouldn't buy it, I don't like it, I found it offensive, as a First Amendment issue, I think it does have a right to be hung in that hallway.
All right, folks, hold tight 1 second. When we come back, we're going to talk HBCUs in Maryland fighting for equal funding. They are now in court. That's next. News One Now on TV One.
Your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America.
I don't bend, I don't break.
It's News One Now with Roland Martin.
Folks, one of the most important lawsuits in the country dealing with HBCUs is taking place this week in Maryland. Bowie State, Coppin State University, University of Maryland Eastern Shore, Morgan State University, they are alleged that Maryland has failed to unravel the segregated structure of higher education. This is a suit that's been going on for quite some time. In 2013, District Court Judge Catherine Blake ruled that the state of Maryland had violated the U.S. Constitution by continuing the practice of having duplicate programs at largely white institutions in Maryland. The judge ordered both parties to submit proposals to remedy this particular issue. We've seen this in other states as well. Of course, we have the famous case out of Mississippi that was argued by Alvin Chambliss. We've seen this being discussed in other states as well. Christina Clark, of course, on our panel with the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights. Christina, your organization has been very much involved in this. This is a huge issue because what we're talking about is in higher education, the way this works is that you assign majors to states and students really make a decision to attend that particular institution based upon those majors. So the allegation is by having duplicate programs, in essence, they're saying don't go to these black colleges. You can freely go to these largely white institutions and avoid those schools. And you also, of course, have the issue of unequal funding.
That's right. So we filed, the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law filed this case about 3 years ago, and we prevailed at the district court level. The court found that basically Maryland is violating the spirit of Brown versus Board of Education by not providing the level of support to HBCUs in the same way that they support TWIs, or traditionally white institutions in the state. They found that, in fact, Maryland was doing better in the 70s than they're doing today, that there was more racial integration at HBCUs because the state was more supportive of those institutions decades ago than they are today. Today, when you take a snapshot, you find that Maryland is providing support to traditionally white institutions at 12 times the rate that they are providing such support to HBCUs. HBCUs are an incredible pipeline to educational opportunity in our country. When we look across the country, often HBCUs, when supported in the right way, are the most racially diverse campuses. They provide a supportive environment for students. My counterpart here attended an HBCU. 75% of people with postgraduate degrees in our country attended HBCUs. But what Maryland has done here essentially violates Brown versus Board of Education. The trial that's underway right now in Baltimore is about the question of how do we fix this? How do we remedy this? We now know that they violated the law. What does Maryland need to do to right this grave wrong? This is the most important higher ed desegregation case in decades. It could have implications for HBCUs in other parts of the country. Our goal at the end of the day is to make sure that those four HBCUs can thrive, that they can be allowed to create programs that attract whites and non-minorities and thrive mm-hmm. and compete with other traditionally white institutions across the state.
And I just... go ahead, Ro.
No, we'll go ahead.
I was just going to say, as a Marylander, I feel like I have to say something here, who went to an HBCU. First of all, I'm so glad you all are taking up this case because it's so important. It really goes at the heart of Brown, which is that separate is inherently unequal. And if you set up these mirroring programs and then give more resources to the traditional white institutions, you're going to see this backwards motion, which we've seen since the 70s. And it's analogous to what we see in the resegregation of K-12 schools, you know, where you actually are worse off in many places than you were post the civil rights movement. So this is a monumental case that's going to have far-reaching implications, not only for HBCUs, but I think in the desegregation movement and education nationwide. So people should be paying attention to it.
Ralph and Amber, at the end of the day, when we talk about these issues, this also, when we begin to discuss income inequality, this is what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, the shortchanging of HBCUs, that they have been shortchanged from the moment they were created.
Exactly.
And here we are in 2017 still having the same battle.
Right.
The funding disparity is an issue. There's no question about that. And that's an issue that definitely needs to be addressed. I mean, there's no reason for one school to be funded at X level and then and the school right across the street to be funded at X minus Y level.
Right. Yeah.
You know, that's funding issue is definitely an issue.
Absolutely.
I commend you guys.
And I look forward to you all taking that up, because I really think that HBCUs, historically black fraternities and sororities, Divine Nine, are definitely going to be playing an important role under this new administration.
Got it.
For black students and brown students across the country.
A5.
Folks, hold it up. Folks, hold it right there. Well, folks, hold it right there. When we come back, we will talk to Johnny Taylor about an initiative that they are doing with the Koch Foundation. You want to see that? That's next, News 1 Now TV 1.
So you want the truth. Well, we got it.
That's how I talk. God knows it. I'm just straight.
It's News 1 Now.
All right, folks, you have two major institutions that really help our HBCUs. One, of course, the United Negro College Fund, and the other is the Thurgood Marshall College Fund, which helps predominantly black institutions, those public institutions. Well, Johnny Taylor is their CEO, and I recently chatted with him, as well as John Harden, Director of University Relations for the Charles Koch Foundation, about an initiative that they are launching. You hear it first right here on News 1 Now TV 1.
Well, it starts with $25.6 million. Mm-hmm. We're going to announce today the unveiling of a new center, the Center for Advancing Opportunity. Roland, it's funded by the Koch Industries and the Charles Koch Foundation, first of its kind initiative to begin listening to the African-American community and other fragile communities. So, what we're really excited about is that it's an unveiling of a new initiative that will be led by HBCU students and faculty. And the focus is going to be on identifying and removing barriers for opportunity for members of fragile communities. Fragile communities is a phrase that we've come up with that we're going to use more and more. It's not poor, it's not disadvantaged. The whole notion is that where there are communities where if we could just remove arbitrary barriers, then these people could really enjoy success and enjoy the opportunities that America has to offer.
So what is this? What does this center look like? I mean, what is it? I mean, is it a physical center? Is it happening at different campuses around the country? I mean, so what is it?
It's a combination. It'll be headquartered here in Washington, D.C. on 9th and F in our headquarters building, and then we will have campus facilities as well, campus centers. And the campus centers will initially be at 3 HBCU campuses to be determined. We're getting ready to identify them. And then we're going to roll out as many of these as the community is willing to accept. We're ultimately trying to find out what are those things that are creating barriers for people in our community.
So, John, why is Koch Foundation doing this?
Yeah, we're doing it because we believe in the transformative power of education, same as TMCF. So Charles Koch's been supporting higher education now for over half a century because we believe that education is the place where people have a phenomenal opportunity, right, to discover and develop their unique skills, their talents, and their abilities that they can then use to improve other people's lives, their own lives, and society. So when Johnny came to us with this vision for this center, for the Center for Advancing Opportunity, we were really excited. TMCF's been doing this for nearly 30 years. It's exciting to see the impact they're having on students. So what a phenomenal opportunity for us to be able to provide the funding so they can make it happen.
When you talk about that, what role will you have beyond just funding this?
Yeah, our role is funding this, right? That's what it's about, is providing the resources to TMCF, because TMCF's got the expertise in the space. You know, I mean, we were at the TMCF gala not long ago, started out with Peebo Bryson singing Beauty and the Beast. Johnny comes out to give to transition, and you think, like, where's he going to go? How do you move from Beauty and the Beast to a TMCF fundraiser? And I love it. He says, look, the beauty's education, the beast is money. This is an opportunity for us to help tame that beast, provide funding so that TMCF can keep doing the beautiful things that they're doing in education.
So when we talk about this center, what will it actually do?
Yes, so the center is going to do three things. First of all, we're going to provide scholarships, undergraduate research scholarships as well as graduate scholarships. We've got to find and grow the next group pipeline of talent for HBCU faculty to actually study these issues. Then we're going to actually every year convene, and I hope you're there, expect you to be there, thought leaders, and we will have a summit, Advancing Opportunity Summit, where we're really going to, you know, you've been to these conferences where everyone says the state of Black America, the state of this, but they don't have data. It's not data informed, and to the extent it is majority schools. That's the big difference here. Typically, and you know, I will tell you, I went to the Advanced Injustice Summit, which was hosted by the Koch Foundation, Charles Koch Foundation, and they had, God bless them, really well-intended white schools studying Ferguson. And that's when I just had a come apart, and I said, we've got to allow our community to tell you what's happening in our community. HBCUs can't be absent from that conversation. We have Harris Stowe State University, which is 45 minutes away from Ferguson, and you have majority schools studying what happened in Ferguson and what are the barriers to the community there. So this is an opportunity to showcase the social scientists that we have on HBCU campuses to solve three issues initially: education, criminal justice reform, and entrepreneurialism. Those are going to be the three initial areas of focus for the center.
John, I asked you, and so before the gala, when Thurgood Marshall Fund met here in D.C., there was a Q&A with Charles Koch.
Right.
Why is the Koch Foundation identified this? Also, previously there was an announcement with the UNCF as well. And so, what has been the impetus behind it? When did this really start?
Mm-hmm. Well, we've been supporting colleges and universities for decades, and among those colleges and universities have been HBCUs, scholars and students at those HBCUs. And so, we're always looking for more opportunities to continue supporting any number of schools. We think the more schools and more scholars and more students, as Johnny was saying, that are part of the conversation, the better. And so when UNCF, when TMCF, when they come to us, say, look, we've got a vision, we've got an idea of how we can expand access to opportunities for education, then we're excited to enter into that conversation, and then we're really excited because it's worked out so well that we can support both.
Well, and I think the key, too, is they didn't come to us. There was not some big RFP. Charles Koch and John and others, their president, didn't find us. We reached out. I literally, one morning, was listening to the news and overheard a conversation where Mr. Koch was talking about criminal justice reform. Literally. I went back to my office, wrote him a letter, and said, if you're serious about it and you want to talk to experts in criminal justice reform, specifically with respect to the African-American community, you must be talking to HBCUs. 3 days later, he responded. Cold. And I said, we have some ideas. And he said, well, let's come in to determine whether or not we have alignment. And we did. It was around education reform, criminal justice reform, and entrepreneurialism. If we get those three things right, we're not going to totally change these fragile communities, but we're going to make major progress.
How do you handle, we've seen this recently with, of course, Talladega College,
yes.
The whole deal with the inauguration parade. Also, when the UNCF made their announcement, there were some criticisms there. How do you handle that where you have critics who will say, well, Johnny, Koch brothers have funded initiatives against African Americans. And so how are you gonna, how do you deal with that? Because I mean, look, that's
right.
It's going to come up.
That's the elephant in the room, right? Ultimately, they've got to trust that after 30 years and a long-term commitment to the HBCU space, we're not going to be used by anyone. And in fact, the Charles Koch Foundation doesn't desire to use us. We came to them and said, here's a problem facing our community. We are mission-oriented, but the reality is you can't have mission without money. And it takes money to get this work done. They are studying fragile communities anyway. I just mentioned other schools are doing it. University of Chicago, Columbia, everyone's studying fragile communities, University of Pennsylvania and those folks. But no one's talking to HBCUs. We're not involved in the conversation. It takes money. Our schools can't just go out and do it without resources. So you pointed out in the beginning, the Charles Koch Foundation is capital. Financial capital. We are the human capital. And so everyone in the world who's concerned about it should know that the HBCUs are not going to be compromised. No one's telling us what to do because the money's written. We are an independent academic center.
Final comment.
Well, I would just say, yeah, I think what's so exciting and part about this partnership is to your question, it gives folks the opportunity to see what we're really about at the Koch Foundation, which Johnny can tell you. What we're really about is supporting education. What TMCF is doing is so exciting, and we are thrilled to be a part of it now, to be providing resources so they can continue to scale up and have a tremendous impact in students and scholars and citizens' lives.
All right, Johnny, we appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, then.
Thanks.
All right, folks, when we come back, number one movie in the country, Hidden Figures. not hitting fences. News 1 9, TV 1, back in 60 seconds.
The first step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number 2, roll out.
The way I roll is, when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We're your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News 1 Now with Roland Martin. Roland Martin.
All right, folks, box office. Number one movie at the box office, Hidden Figures. Of course, it is a movie about a group of sisters who were mathematicians at NASA when, of course, our NASA space program was in operation. Of course, it stars Taraji P. Henson, Octavia Spencer, Janelle Monáe. It is a true story of these sisters. It grossed $22.8 million in its wide release, jumping 16 spots from number 17 to number one. So certainly congratulations to all involved. Also, Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, was number two, raking in $22 million in 4,100 theaters. We'll see if Hidden Figures can maintain number one status at the box office. Folks, birthdays, let's give a shout out. Producer Issa Rae, of course, she turns 32. Singer Avery turns 37. Rapper Raekwon turns 47. Former NBA star Dominique Wilkins turns 57. All right, folks, tomorrow also, Steve Bradford, is your birthday today as well. So California Senator Steve Bradford, today his birthday as well. Folks, tomorrow, I'll be back in D.C., and we'll be talking about Reverend Al Sharpton's march this weekend when it comes to the issue of civil rights. Folks, I will have more from the Black Caucus of Sacramento later today. Catch me on Periscope and Facebook. I got to go. Holla from Sacramento.
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News 1 Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV 1.